My name is Paul Aronson, and you're listening to Tokyo Progressive's Chocopol News.
They started by shaking hands. We said, Salam Alaikum, peace be upon you. Then the first pebbles flew past my face. A small boy tried to grab my bag, then another. Then someone punched me in the back. Then young men broke my glasses, began smashing stones into my face and head. I couldn't see for the blood pouring down my forehead and swamping my eyes. And even then, I understood. I couldn't blame them for what they were doing. In fact, if I were the Afghan refugees of Killer Abdullah, close to the Afghan-Pakistan border, I would have done just the same to Robert Fisk, or any other Westerner I could find. How do you walk out of a dream when the characters suddenly turn hostile? I saw one of the men who had been all smiles when we shook hands. He wasn't smiling now. Some of the smaller boys were still laughing, but their grins were transforming into something else. The respected foreigner, the man who had been all Salam Alaikum a few minutes ago, was upset, frightened, on the run. The West was being brought low. The next blow came from a man I saw carrying a big stone in his right hand. He brought it down on my forehead with tremendous force, and something hot and liquid splashed down my face and lips and chin. I was kicked. I knew that I had to respond, or so I reasoned in my stunned state. I had to die. I guess I should thank Lebanon. For 25 years I have covered Lebanon's wars, and the Lebanese used to teach me over and over again how to stay alive. Take a decision, any decision, but don't do nothing. I turned on the man on my right, the one holding the bloody stone in his hand, and I bashed my fist into his mouth. I couldn't see very much. My eyes were not only short-sighted without my glasses, but were misting over with a red haze. But I saw the man sort of cough, and a tooth fall from his lip, and then he fell back on the road. For a second, the crowd stopped. Then I went for the other man, clutching my bag under my arm and banging my fist into his nose. He roared in anger, and it suddenly turned all red. I missed another man with a punch, hit one more in the face, and ran. I was back in the middle of the road, but could not see. I brought my hands to my eyes and they were full of blood, and with my fingers I tried to scrape the gooey stuff out. It made a kind of sucking sound, but I began to see again and realized that I was crying and weeping and that the tears were cleaning my eyes of blood. What had I done? I kept asking myself. I had been punching and attacking Afghan refugees, the very people I'd been writing about for so long. The very dispossessed, mutilated people whom my own country, among others, was killing along with the Taliban just across the border. God spare me, I thought. I think I actually said it. The men whose families our bombers were killing were now my enemies too. Then something quite remarkable happened. A man walked up to me, very calmly, and took me by the arm. I couldn't see him very well for all the blood that was running into my eyes, but he was dressed in a kind of robe and wore a turban and had a white grey beard, and he led me away from the crowd. I looked over my shoulder. There were now 100 men behind me and a few stones skittered along the road, but they were not aimed at me, presumably to avoid hitting the stranger. He was like an Old Testament figure or some Bible story. the Good Samaritan, a Muslim man, perhaps a mullah in the village, who was trying to save my life. And there, beside the road, was a Red Cross, Red Crescent convoy. The crowd was still behind us, but two of the medical attendants pulled me behind one of their vehicles, poured water over my hands and face, and began pushing bandages onto my head and face and the back of my head. "Lie down and we'll cover you with a blanket so they can't see you," one of them said. They were both Muslims, Bangladeshis, and their names should be recorded because they were good men and true. Muhammad Abdul Halim and Sikta Mohaktis Ahmed. I lay on the floor groaning, aware that I might live. I had spent more than 2.5 decades reporting the humiliation and misery of the Muslim world, and now their anger had embraced me too. Or had it? There were Muhammad and Sikdar of the Red Crescent, and Fazir, who came panting back to the car, incandescent at our treatment, and Amun Allah, who invited us to his home for medical treatment. And there was the Muslim saint who had taken me by the arm, and I realized they were all the Afghan men and boys who had attacked me, who should never have done so, but whose brutality was entirely the product of others, of us, of we who had armed their struggle against the Russians and ignored their pain and laughed at their civil war and then armed and paid them again for the war of civilization just a few miles away and then bombed their homes and ripped up their families and called them collateral damage. So I thought I should write about what happened to us in this fearful, silly, bloody, tiny incident. I feared other versions would produce a different narrative of how a British journalist was beaten up by a mob of Afghan refugees. And of course, that's the point. The people who were assaulted were the Afghans, the scars inflicted by us, by B-52s, not by them. And I'll say it again, if I was an Afghan refugee in Killah Abdullah, I would have done just what they did. I would have attacked Robert Fisk, or any other Westerner I could find.
That was Chris Hunt, reading a selection on a CD called Black Christmas, which was actually a text written by journalist Robert Fisk after he was beaten and almost killed in Afghanistan several months ago. We'll be talking a little bit more about Robert Fisk shortly, but let me tell you something about Chris Hunt. Chris Hunt has a website, which is http://wisehat.com. That's wisehat.com. And this is a website for students and teachers. And it's quite unique. And I think if you'll take a look, you'll see what I mean. And Chris is very deeply involved in non-competitive games. And let me read one of his selections. He says, "I've been designing games since the age of 8. I've had a game in Virgin Megastore's bestsellers list. I've played chess at county level and drawn with a British chess champion, and my gut feeling is that competitive games are not conducive to learning. What's competition? In the book No Contest by Alfie Cohen, Cohen defines competition as mutually exclusive goal attainment, or MEGA, M-E-G-A. I benefit, you don't. I win when you lose. So by this definition, the idea of competing with oneself is a contradiction. I can challenge myself, I can test myself, but I can't compete with myself. Competition is created through scarcity. A prize is a form of artificial scarcity. How often do you create artificial scarcity in your classroom? Do students compete for your attention? Do you ever manipulate so they do? No. Do you ever ask questions with definite answers to the whole class, like what's the capital of Italy or who can spell elephant? Such questions make competition. The students who think they know compete to answer. The students who think they don't know are sidelined. Different make statements like, I like the way Shizuko is sitting quietly. A competition for which student can sit the quietest has just been created, and all the students except Shizuko have just lost. Play is process-oriented. It's an end in itself. Competition is goal-oriented. It follows that the true nature of play and competition are different. For me, learning takes place in a safe, motivating environment. Play is conducive to learning. Competition mitigates against it. Authors such as David Paul, such as the text Finding Out, state that competition is a powerful motivating force, but competition motivates students to win. Winning is not learning. In the worst case, victory in games can become a horrible one-upmanship. English is not enjoyed for its own sake, but becomes a means to put down others. Competition favors able students. Once a child feels there is no chance of winning, the child switches off. A clear signal is the way the child uses the game equipment. If the child begins to mess around with the equipment or uses it in a laborious or exaggerated fashion, then that is indication that the child is not focused on the activity. If the child's not focused, then the value of the activity is nil. Now, one solution is to engage in what David Paul creates, creative cheating. I'm reading from Chris Hunt's website, wisehat.com. And David Paul has something called creative teaching. The teacher should, according to David Paul, use surreptitious ways to keep the game balanced and therefore interesting. But as a game purist, Chris Hunt says, I would suggest that if cheating is necessary, then somewhere there is a fundamental design flaw. Cheating does work, but the teacher runs the risk of being accused of favoritism. This can be very damaging to the cohesion of children's classes, especially when children are young. And I think teachers, whether teachers of children or teachers of anybody here in Japan or wherever you are, would benefit greatly from taking a look at some of what Chris is doing. Chris also makes games. He has some CDs. He's got a number of things. He's got things for learners, things for teachers, and quite a unique way of purchasing some of the things that he produces. So if you take a look at http://wisehat.com, I think you'll be greatly rewarded. Now, Chris was talking on his CD, reading on his CD from journalist Robert Fisk, and as I'm recording this right now, just a day or two ago, we received word that Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl was killed. And I'd like to read the latest article from Robert Fisk on this after this song from Joan Baez, or I should say this poem from Joan Baez, In Guernica, by Norman Rustin.
In Guernica, the dead children were laid out in order upon the sidewalk, in their white starched dresses, in their pitiful white dresses. On their foreheads and breasts are the little holes where death came in as thunder while they were playing their important summer games. Do not weep for them, Madre. They're gone forever, the little ones, straight to heaven, to the saints, and God will fill the bullet holes with candy.
That was Joan Baez doing In Guernica by the poet Norman Rustin. And just before, we heard Chris Hunt reading something that Robert Fisk wrote after he was almost killed in Afghanistan. And here is an essay that Robert Fisk just wrote in The Independent on February 23rd, 2002. He said, the murder of Daniel Pearl of the Wall Street Journal was as revolting as it was outrageous, but why was he killed? Because he was a Westerner? A Kaffir? Because he was an American, or because he was a journalist? And if he was killed because he was a reporter, what has happened to the protection which we and our craft used to enjoy? In Pakistan and Afghanistan, we can be seen as Kaffirs, as unbelievers. Our faces, our hair, even our spectacles mark us as Westerners. The Muslim cleric who wished to talk to me in an Afghan refugee village outside Peshawar last October was stopped by a man who pointed at me and asked, "Why are you taking this Kaffir into our mosque?" Weeks later, a crowd of Afghan refugees, grief-stricken at the slaughter of their relatives in a U.S. B-52 bomber air raid, tried to kill me because they thought I was American. But over the past quarter century, I have witnessed the slow, painful, dangerous erosion of respect for our work. We used to risk our lives in wars. We still do. But journalists were rarely deliberate targets. We were impartial witnesses to conflict, often the only witnesses, the first writers of history. Even the nastiest militias understood this. Protect him. Look after him. He's a journalist. I recall a Palestinian guerrilla ordering his men when I entered the burning Lebanese town of Bandoun in 1983. But in Lebanon, in Algeria, and then in Bosnia, the protection began to disintegrate. Reporters in Beirut were taken hostage. The AP's Terry Anderson disappeared for almost 7 years, while Algerian journalists were hunted down and beheaded by Islamist groups throughout the 90s. Olivier Kemenier, a French cameraman, was cruelly shot down in the Kasbah area of Algiers as his wounded colleague lay weeping by his side. Pasting TV stickers on your car in Sarajevo was as much an invitation to the Serb snipers above the city to shoot at journalists as it was a protection. Where did we go wrong? I suspect the rot started in Vietnam. Reporters have identified themselves with armies for decades. In both world wars, journalists worked in uniforms. Dropping behind enemy lines with U.S. commandos did not spare an AP reporter from a Nazi firing squad. But these were countries in open conflict, reporters whose nations had officially declared war. Wearing a uniform enabled journalists to claim the protection of the Geneva Convention. In civilian clothes, they could be shot as spies. It was in Vietnam that reporters started wearing uniforms and carrying weapons and shooting those weapons at America's enemies, even though their country was not officially at war, and even when they could have carried out their duties without wearing soldiers' clothes. In Vietnam, reporters were murdered because they were reporters. This odd habit of journalists to be part of the story, to play an almost theatrical role in wars, slowly took hold. When the Palestinians evacuated Beirut in 1982, I noticed that several French reporters were wearing Palestinian scarves. Israeli reporters turned up in occupied southern Lebanon with pistols. Then in the 1991 Gulf War, American and British television reporters started dressing up in military costumes, appearing on screen, complete with helmets and military camouflage fatigues, as if they were members of the 82nd Airborne or the Hussars. One American journalist even arrived in boots camouflaged with painted leaves, although a glance at any desert suggests that this would not have served much purpose. In the Kurdish flight into the mountains of northern Iraq, more reporters could be found wearing Kurdish clothes. In Pakistan and Afghanistan last year, the same phenomenon occurred. Reporters in Peshawar could be seen wearing Pashtun hats. Why? No one could ever supply me with an explanation. What on earth was CNN's Walter Rogers doing in U.S. Marine costume at an American camp outside Kandahar? Mercifully, someone told him to take it off after his first broadcast. Then Geraldo Rivera of Fox News arrived in Jalalabad with a gun. He fully intended, he said, to kill Osama bin Laden. It was the last straw. The reporter had now become combatant. Perhaps we no longer care about our profession. Maybe we're all quick to demean our own jobs, to sneer at each other, to adopt the ridiculous title of hacks, when we should regard the job as foreign correspondent as a decent, honorable profession. I was astounded last December when an American newspaper headline announced that I had deserved the beating I received at the hands of that Afghan crowd. I had almost died, but the article by Mark Stein carried a headline that a, quote, multiculturalist, me, gets his due, unquote. My sin, of course, was to explain that the crowd had lost relatives in America's B-52 raids, that I would have done the same in their place. That shameful, unethical headline, I should add, appeared in Daniel Pearl's own newspaper, The Wall Street Journal. Can we do better? I think so. It's not that reporters in military costume, Rogers in his silly marine helmet and Rivera clowning around with a gun, or even me in my gas cape a decade ago, helped to kill Daniel Pearl. No, he was murdered by vicious men, but we are all of us dressing up in combatants' clothes or adopting the national dress of people, helping to erode the shield of neutrality and decency which saved our lives in the past. If we don't stop now, how can we protest when next our colleagues are seized by ruthless men who claim we are spies? Let's listen to Joan Baez doing Song in the Blood by the French poet Jacques Prévert, translated by Lawrence Ferlinghetti. I'm Paul Aronson, and you're listening to Tokyo Progressive's Chocopole News.
There are great puddles of blood on the world. Where is it all going, all this spilled blood? Is it the earth that drinks it and gets drunk? Funny kind of drunkography then, so wise, so monotonous. No, the earth doesn't get drunk. The earth doesn't turn askew. It pushes its little car regularly, its four seasons. Rain, snow, hail, fair with. Never is it drunk. It's with difficulty it permits itself from time to time an unhappy little volcano. It turns the earth. It turns with its trees, its gardens, its houses. It turns with its great pools of blood. And all living things turn with it and bleed. It doesn't give a damn, the earth. It turns and all living things set up a howl. It doesn't give a damn. It turns. It doesn't stop turning. And the blood doesn't stop running. Where's it going, all this spilled blood? Murder's blood, war's blood, misery's blood, and the blood of men tortured in prisons, and the blood of children calmly tortured by their papa and their mom, and the blood of men whose heads bleed in padded cells, and the roofer's blood when the roofer slips and falls from the roof, and the blood that comes and flows in great gushes with the newborn, with the new baby. The mother cries, the baby cries, the blood flows, the earth turns. The earth doesn't stop turning, the blood doesn't stop flowing. Where's it going, all this spilled blood? Blood of the blackjacked, of the humiliated, of suicides, of firing squad victims, of the condemned, and the blood of those that die just like that, by accident. In the street, a living being goes by with all his blood inside. Suddenly, there he is, dead, and all his blood outside. And other living beings make the blood disappear. They carry the body away, but it's stubborn, the blood. And there, where the dead one was, much later, all black, a little blood still stretches. Coagulated blood. Life's rust, body's rust. Blood curdled like milk when it turns. When it turns like the earth that turns with its milk, with its cows, with its living, with its dead. The earth that turns with its trees, with its living beings, its houses. The earth that turns with marriages, burials, shells, regiments. The earth that turns and turns and turns with its great streams of blood.